We're not winning in Afghanistan right now, and we will correct this.
Afghanistan remains an unstable country. It's Thursday, June 15th. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington, inviting you to join us online at VOA Asia Facebook. Also ahead, the Koreas are on President Trump's agenda. Big data is big business in China. Plastics threaten oceans in Asia. A vegetable for health and printing guitars. It all starts now on VOA Asia. The United States is not winning in Afghanistan. That's according to U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis, who testified before lawmakers during a Defense Department budget hearing Tuesday. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb has the latest.
After nearly 5 months in power, the Trump administration is still working on a new plan for how to stabilize Afghanistan. Tuesday, members of the U.S. Senate Armed Services Committee let top Pentagon leaders know they are sick of waiting.
We want a strategy, and I don't think that's a hell of a lot to ask.
By mid-July, we'll be able to brief you in detail, sir. We're putting it together now, and there are actions being taken to make certain that we don't pay a price for the delay.
200 meters to the east.
Secretary Mattis said the U.S. was drawing strength from allies as part of the plan, which takes time. There are about 13,000 NATO troops in Afghanistan. Sending more is under consideration. He said the defense team needs to alter the current strategy, which officials agree have placed the war-torn country in a stalemate against the Afghan Taliban.
We're not winning in Afghanistan right now, and we will correct this as soon as possible.
Mattis defined winning in Afghanistan as when the Afghan government is strong enough to drive down enemy violence to a manageable level for local security forces to handle. He said that will require a residual force of American and allied troops who would train Afghans while maintaining high-end security capabilities. Carla Babb, VOA News, The Pentagon.
Mattis acknowledged the Taliban had a good year last year and is trying to have a good one this year. Right now, he added, they are surging. Earlier this year, the U.S. commander, General John Nicholson, said he needed a few thousand more troops. Rand Corporation South Asia analyst Jonah Blank tells VOA the bleak assessment has remained the same for years and indicated Mattis may ask for more U.S. troops.
The reports are that he may well be asking for an additional several thousand troops, and also, according to reports that have come out today, the White House has said that he will be able to set his own troop level. A big question mark there is, has the White House provided any parameters within which he can set his troop level? Could he come out and say, I want 30,000 troops? Or is this merely within the range of, say, 2,000 to 4,000?
There are political ramifications, as the U.S. Congress is not inclined to send a greater military presence to Afghanistan.
Part of the real difficulty here, and Secretary of Defense Mattis has put his finger on it, is that the U.S. is not winning and that the U.S. does not have the resources to win. However, what Secretary of Defense Mattis has not really discussed is what sort of resources would be necessary to win. Let's remember that under President Obama, there were over 100,000 troops in Afghanistan, and that was not sufficient.
Jonah Blank says it highlights shortcomings in the Afghan security forces.
It's a failure of the Afghan security forces to defeat a very difficult insurgency. And that's an important thing to remember. Insurgencies are very, very difficult. The U.S., the most powerful nation that the world has ever seen, was unable to defeat a Taliban insurgency. So it's a little bit unfair to expect that the Afghan government and the Afghan National Security Forces could achieve a mission that the U.S., with 100,000-plus troops, was unable to accomplish.
Jonah Blank said the failure so far to defeat the Taliban underscores the difficulty of defeating an insurgency that has safe havens, foreign backing, and support among much of the population. These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on VOAnews.com. Lawless waters test Southeast Asian nations in fight against Islamic State. Prosecutors give summation at trial of Khmer Rouge leaders. Australia settles lawsuit with detained asylum seekers. Vietnam formally charges blogger activist honored by the United States. Big data gives China's top three internet firms big leverage. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories, and there's also a whole lot more when you visit us at Facebook at VOA Asia and check out our VOAnews.com website. VOA Asia continues. U.S. Undersecretary of State Thomas Shannon held talks Wednesday with his South Korean counterpart in Seoul to prepare for President Moon Jae-in's visit to Washington later this month. The White House said President Donald Trump and his South Korean counterpart will, quote, further strengthen the ironclad U.S.-ROK alliance in advanced cooperation on economic and global issues, including North Korea's growing nuclear and missile threat.
We did focus on the recent provocations of North Korea in its missile launches and its continuing misbehavior, and underscored the ironclad commitment of both countries to our alliance and to our partnership to protect not just the people of Korea, but also alliance forces here in Korea and other important security partners in the region and beyond.
Shannon had little to say about the medical evacuation Tuesday of detained U.S. student Otto Warmbier by North Korea. He said Special U.S. Envoy on North Korea Policy Joseph Yoon accompanied the University of Virginia student home to the Cincinnati, Ohio area. Warmbier, who was sentenced in March 2016 to 15 years hard labor for trying to steal a propaganda banner, reportedly fell ill from botulism and lapsed into a coma when given a sleeping pill soon after his trial. He is now at the University of Cincinnati Medical Center. It was Yoon who went to Pyongyang and demanded Warmbier's release on humanitarian grounds following diplomatic contacts with the North that allowed Swedish officials to attempt to see all four detained Americans. But the Washington Post, quoting Trump administration officials, said the Swedes saw only one detainee, not Warmbier. It said Yoon was informed of Warmbier's condition by Pyongyang's UN ambassador. Stephen Norper, senior director of the New York-based Korea Society, tells VOA's Victor Beatty at some point there must be a full accounting about why Warmbier was kept in prison despite his medical condition.
The fact that the reports indicate that he's been in a coma for over a year and that he is in need of emergency medical care is not a good sign. So there will certainly be, beyond the human tragedy, repercussions in terms of demands for accountability, because this happened under North Korea's arcane and inhuman policy of detaining Americans, and there will be demands on Capitol Hill. I'm sure there will be demands in other parts of government, and certainly there will be demands among the general public as this is reported and as more details come out.
Obviously, the North Korean officials knew that he was seriously ill a year ago.
Yeah, it did, and it's reflective of that opaque nature of communications, which don't exist on any good level, and the fact that the family, you know, appeared to have some knowledge but refrained from much comment. Clearly, they wanted their son out of harm's way, and it leaves the American government in a bit of a bind because you still have three Americans who are detained, and winning their release is now of critical importance as well.
Do you think the Warmbier case will improve their prospects for freedom?
Potentially. You know, we'll have to see what happens in terms of his state of health, what the prognosis is. Clearly, the U.S. government will be pushing to win the freedom of the other three individuals, and perhaps with the visit by the former NBA star Dennis Rodman, that may be designed to provide him with a reward to take home. Clearly, anything that can be done to get those three Americans out of harm's way and return them to the United States is of critical importance.
I want to ask you about the diplomatic back and forth between North Korea and the U.S. Direct talks, apparently, in Oslo back in May. Is this unusual?
Well, those talks were done primarily at a track 1.5, a semi-official, or track 2 unofficial level. There have been an entire series of unofficial talks in recent years. Those are designed to try to at least explore opportunities that could emerge at the official level. But the fact of the matter is there is a critical lack of communication, especially after the North Koreans stepped away in July of 2016 from the New York Channel, which was their official form of dialogue to Washington.
The other three detained Americans are Kim Jong-chul, arrested and charged with espionage and sentenced to 10 years hard labor, and two other Korean Americans who worked for the private Pyongyang University of Science and Technology. Happening now in Asia, in the United States, both the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security blame North Korea for hacks targeting media, finance, and infrastructure around the world since 2009. They say the digital attacks are likely to keep coming. Stay up to date with the latest headlines online with VOA 60. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad you're spending part of your day with us on VOA Asia. China's three big internet-driven companies, Alibaba, Tencent, and Baidu, are set to influence a vast section of the country's business because they control data concerning the consumer and social behavior of millions of people. The awesome power comes from the government's drive to develop a big data industry, which is thriving in China. Several other players, including utilities like phone companies and retail chains, are also trying to dip into the newly discovered pot of money from buyers who need information to understand buying preferences of potential customers and design their products and strategies in line with the data flows. Chiang Junwen is a professor of marketing at the China-Europe International Business School.
It's an improvement to do a better job, but unfortunately, your lifeline is more and more depending on these big three guys.
Recent studies have shown that nearly 90% of China's 731 million online users have made at least one online purchase, often involving the use of Baidu search facilities, e-commerce sites, and third-party transactions using mobile phone apps.
Now they also know consumers offline. People are buying things and using their third-party payment system. And those information also being captured by, you know, Tencent and Alibaba. And that is huge because now they know the both online and offline information of consumers.
These companies own a wide range of businesses that makes it possible for them to gather both online and offline data that is generated when a customer uses a phone app to make payments at a physical shop. Alibaba owns Alipay, while Tencent runs the highly popular WeChat service, which offers mobile payment options. Shadiza Ahmed, visiting academic in the Technology and Economics Division of Mercator Institute of Chinese Studies, says Baidu, China's biggest internet search engine, holds the kind of influence that Google does in other countries.
They've diversified the services they offer. About Alibaba, from the examples you just, they're big in e-commerce. The kinds of data they generate come from, you know, anything ranging from what you buy online to, you know, your bill payment, travel bookings you do in, for example, the Alipay app.
She adds,
people use the same platforms to make purchases, so kind of there is a sense of extreme power in this situation because you can do all of this within one platform.
These companies have a very strong predictive power that comes from the vast store of historical data and real-time data that they're collecting from users of different services.
They kind of are able to anticipate the next thing a user might want before the user themselves is aware of it.
The expansion of big data has given rise to serious concerns about the privacy of millions of people who reveal both their transaction information and facets of social behavior through social media. China has seen the rise of a black market for data. Data sellers offer a wide range of data on a targeted person, business, or community by cracking into official databases and privately run sites. But Chinese officials insist the government has put in place strong safeguards. The government has established a big data exchange center in Guiyang to encourage private and state-run companies to trade in data in a transparent manner and help the industry find out the real price of the information. The center has come in for some praise by foreign companies who have visited it, but some questions remain unanswered. Saibal Dasgupta sent us this story from Beijing. Our thanks to him. You're listening to VOA Asia.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This news alert from VOA Asia. Chinese President Xi Jinping met with FIFA President Gianni Infantino in Beijing Wednesday in a rare meeting for Xi and a sports association head. Following speculation, China will bid to host the 2030 or 2034 World Cup. You'll score every time you visit VOA Asia Facebook for interesting stories. This is VOA Asia. VOA Asia continues. World Ocean Day, which happened earlier this month, is an annual focus on the threats to our watery planet. It's a long list: overfishing, climate change, algae blooms, and plastic. Plastic is literally everywhere, on the surface, in the deep, and all along the shorelines. VOA's Kevin Enix reports in India, one dedicated group of fishermen turned conservationists is doing its part to help solve that particular problem.
These one-time fishermen spend their days hauling in a new catch, garbage. This is a normal day's haul, a boat full of plastic trash and old fishing nets and wildlife caught in the deadly webs.
If we don't take it out, nothing will survive. If we do not take out the abandoned net, then it will kill the fish and the marine life. We won't be able to save anything in the water because of the plastic. There won't be fish or corals. Only plastic will survive. One day will come when people will see only a sea of plastic.
These former fishermen are employed as part of the United Nations program. Most of the communities here rely on fish for their meals, so keeping the waters clean isn't so much a matter of environmentalism, but survival.
The coastal areas, you find a lot of trash everywhere, on the beaches, on the water, everywhere you have the trash. And that is even causing damage to the wildlife. Some of the turtles chew plastic as if it is jellyfish, or it gets into the system of some of the dolphins and other animals.
Keeping the water clean also increases the tourist value. The region is biologically diverse and has a thriving scuba trade.
During the day, they take the tourists for scuba diving, but they are conscious that their environment has to be kept clean. And that is prompting them to keep the biodiversity intact. If there are elements like pollution getting into the waters, they are the people who would raise the voice. So that is the kind of synergy that we are trying to build.
Always we are just getting lots of things from ocean. Okay, so we trying to give at least 10% to the ocean.
But the battle is ongoing, and despite their best efforts, the World Economic Forum predicts that by 2025, there will be 1 ton of plastic in the ocean for every 3 tons of fish. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
Developing at this hour in Asia, 9 gay and transgender couples have departed Shanghai, China on a cruise ship along with 800 supporters for a group wedding at sea. It's an effort to raise awareness of intolerant attitudes toward gay relationships in China. You'll find top stories and interesting features every day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, diabetes is a growing health problem, especially now in Asia. Swedish researchers say a compound found in broccoli appears to be at least as effective as a widely used drug to treat diabetes. VOA's Jessica Berman reports they also think the ingredient could be a safe alternative for lowering blood sugar, even though some people don't care for the vegetable.
While former First Lady Michelle Obama made it her mission to encourage Americans to eat more vegetables, back in 1990, then-President George H.W. Bush put his fork down when it came to one vegetable in particular.
I do not like broccoli, and I haven't liked it since I was a little kid, and my mother made me eat it, and I'm President of the United States, and I'm not going to eat any more broccoli.
But the latest study of broccoli could have changed Mr. Bush's mind. The vegetable contains an agent called sulforaphane that appears in clinical trials to work as well as metformin at reducing blood sugar levels in diabetics. That could be good news for a significant percentage of the 300 million type 2 diabetics around the world who cannot take metformin, a first-line therapy, because of potential damage to the kidneys and stomach upset. Dr. Anders Rosengren of the Lund University Diabetes Center in Sweden discovered the potential of sulforaphane in lowering HbA1c, a blood biomarker of long-term glucose control. He led a team of researchers who used a computer model to sort through a public database of more than 3,800 promising compounds to find sulforaphane.
This is very exciting because there have been so many claims over the years of different food, dietary components having different health effects. But here we have really scientifically based proof of that it has an effect on type 2 diabetes.
In a 12-week study of 97 patients with type 2 diabetes, sulforaphane lowered HbA1c levels by a relative reduction of 10% over the control group, because it would be unethical not to treat patients with a known blood sugar-lowering drug. Rosengren says all of the participants in the study were on metformin, including the ones who got sulforaphane. The findings were published in the journal Science Translational Medicine. Rosengren looks forward to conducting another trial with pre-diabetic patients.
If you would have people without metformin at all, it might be that the sulforaphane effect might be even stronger.
In the study, researchers gave subjects up to 5 kilograms of sulforaphane extract, an amount that would be difficult to consume in a day, except in pill form. For diabetics who hate broccoli, that could be an answer to their dilemma. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
Musicians tend to talk about their instruments in terms of tone and sound as often as the brand. And electric guitarists aren't any different. They can expound on the bright sound of the Fender or the bass-heavy Gibsons. VOA's Kevin Enix has some new music for our ears. There is a 3D-printed electric guitar, and that could just be the beginning for 3D-printed musical instruments.
It certainly sounds like an electric guitar, but 3D printing technology has turned it into an instrument that looks as unique as a guitarist's sound. This guitar was printed by a professor at Sweden's Lund University using metal powder and lasers.
They sound great. I mean, these are electric guitars. So, you know, scientifically, what makes a sound is the magnets on the pickups picking up the string vibrations. Anything that affects the vibrations will affect the sound to a very small extent. But because there are electric guitars, they sound as good as any other electric guitar. Acoustic guitars would be a different story.
Some professional guitarists are not as easily impressed. This one says the 3D guitar is not better or worse, it's just different.
But ultimately, a guitar that's made out of a composite material like the printing material is going to resonate in a certain way, which is going to affect the sound, which could be a good thing, because you can make it consistent that way.
Lund has used 3D printing to make a number of electronic instruments, but he wants to move into a new medium.
I mean, this is an electric guitar. It sounds like an electric guitar. I believe that with wind instruments, you can make some completely unique sounding instruments. You do a flute that plays chords, for example.
Some of Lund's creations have found their way on stage, and he says his goal is to create custom-made guitars that cost the same as the more traditional wood-bodied designs. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
Well, no matter how you like your music, we're glad that you listened with us today at VOA Asia. You can get our program in a lot of different ways. iTunes and SoundCloud are a very good way to download the program. Take it wherever you go. And we'd like to say a special hello to everyone listening in Tainan, Taiwan, on the Voice of Chungrung, Star Radio FM 88.3 at Chungrung Christian University. Thanks for being with us today. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Jim Harmon, managing editor Diane Gao, Ali Ogden and David Bird are part of our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We hope you have a super day.